new episode of Outside the Panel with your host, Johnny the Machine Hughes.
So, 3, 2. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Outside the Panels, the show where we talk to creators about their creations. It's that simple. I'm your host, Johnny the Machine Hughes, and joining me this time for some super fun, sexy time talk, we have writer, artist, creator extraordinaire, Meredith McLaren. Meredith, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Excellent.
Glad to be here.
Okay. Now, before we get going, as you may have guessed from the title, we are going to be talking about the super cool, super fun book from Meredith that came out a couple of weeks ago. So, if you're of an age where you are offended by sexual content and sexual conversation, switch the dial, come back in about an hour's time, and listen to something else. There's plenty of shows on the UCPN for you to get your teeth into. If, on the other hand, you want to talk to about a cool book with a cool creator, stick around. All right? That's your warning. Right, Meredith, how's it going? How's things where you are?
Good. We're just beginning to come into fall. Like, the heat is beginning to break. I live in the desert, so.
Don't say that. I'm going to Mexico, so I don't want fall. I want summer.
Mexico should be fine for a little while longer.
All right.
When I say fall, that's a spring anywhere else.
All right. Okay. That's cool. I can handle that.
Cool.
Right. Let's start at the top and work our way down. First question, pretty generic. I'm really sorry, but what is it about comics? How did you break into them and why comics for yourself?
Well, initially I thought I wanted to go into animation.
Oh, okay.
I did briefly try to double major in both animation and comics. What I found was at the time that I was studying animation, everyone had decided that 2D animation was dead and 3D was the way to go.
Okay.
And that wasn't really an art style that appealed to me. Animation takes more patience than I'm probably capable of. So moving fully into comics seemed like a great idea. I had been fully immersed in my youth with manga and anime. And so I knew how far the storytelling genre could go. And I knew what it was capable of. And it seemed like a good fit.
Okay. Cool. It's interesting to talk about animation as being kind of like needing lots of patience. I was talking to a guy at work who was into animation. He was like saying, oh yeah, there's like, even when you don't see stuff, you've got to do stuff. I'm like, what? What do you mean? He's like, you can't just have a person move. You've got to like make them bounce and stuff as if they're walking properly, but you never see the legs. It was like some sort of epiphany moment for him. You know, that was the quote of the day. You never see the legs. It's like watching the Muppet Show or something.
Yes.
Or Sesame Street. All right. Yeah. Okay. So 2D animation is kind of traditional stuff. 3D would be things like Toy Story.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Okay. So moving into comics, back when you were in your major, what sort of stuff were you reading back then? You mentioned manga. Is there any particular books that stood out?
Let's see. I've talked about it before. There was a shoujo, which is a girl-focused manga called From Far Away that I really liked. It was a fantasy book.
Okay.
Let's see. What else was I reading at the time?
Is manga still a heavy influence for yourself? Do you still pick up the odd book or...?
Well, what happens, it's interesting what happens. You start working in comics and you stop reading them.
Tell
because
me about
you
it.
Just don't have the time. You're always hustling.
Tell me about it. I must have a review pile that's like 10 comics deep, but I haven't read anything of my own order for the last, 3 weeks. It's like, what?
Oh, yeah. Every artist I know has a to-read pile that's just, you wonder if it's even worth it to start tackling it or if you should just kibosh the whole thing.
Yeah. My wife, I'll go to a comic book mart, which is kind of like, I don't know if you have them over in the States. It's kind of like a garage sale, but just about comic books. No cosplays, no other things. It's just like dudes and girls selling comic books and stuff. And I'll go to these and I'll spend like £50. And my wife's like, how can you spend £50? You've still got that big pile to read. I'm like, yeah, but these are this. You know, this is Batman. The other one's like, X-Men. I'll get to them eventually. And she's like, what? Alphabetically? I was like, all right, smart ass.
They're all different stories.
Yeah, that's it. And by which point my wife's rolling her eyes saying, really? You'll get out of the trap. I'm like, all right, whatever.
Yeah. That I do try to keep aware of what's popular in manga and animation and other and more Western comics, just so I can like follow conversation. I don't get to read all that often.
All right, okay, that's cool. So super fun, sexy time.
Yes.
What was the inspiration behind the book? What made you think, what would happen if supervillains end?
Yeah.
How did that thought go along?
So I really enjoy stories where when they have a fantastical foundation, they're doing something domestic. So I've always loved the stories where it's, two superheroes going to the grocery store, or there's one where Spider-Man has to get his costume fixed. I want to know what happens when Captain America goes to IKEA.
Maybe that's where he goes to keep his shield polished.
Yes.
Maybe you get some like special sort of like vibranium rub or something that just gives it that like ding moment.
Yes. My editor Ari Yarwood let me know that they were opening up this imprint that was going to be more adult books at Oni Press called Limerence. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to know if I had anything I wanted to pitch to them. And it took me maybe a day to realize that I would love to see a book about the domestic lives, relationships of superheroes and supervillains and how they negotiate that and what parallels you could draw between the problems they have to negotiate and the problems everyone has to negotiate.
Okay. So let me ask you a quick question then. So that sounds great. Where is the kind of, the jump off point then? Because there's a lot of stuff going on in this book, which I actually love because it's the character's version of normal. It's not like my version or anybody else's version. What goes on in the book is their normal life.
Yeah.
But to others looking from the outside, there's a lot of kink going on in here. So how what's that jump point that made you think, well, hold on, it's going to be superheroes, villains having relationships and then turning that kind of into the kink element of that?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think part of it is I've always been fascinated by the academics of sex and the psychology and, just like why we've gotten to the point we have with, what's acceptable, what's not,
Okay.
And I think because I'm immersed myself in that pool of knowledge, I am, I don't want to say more aware of the kink community than the normal person, but I maybe get a skewed idea of how prevalent kink is in everyone else's life.
All right, okay. I can see that. Yeah, I can totally see that. I thought it was quite ominous where you paused there, that your clock went off and chimed. I was like, oh, what's going on here? It's a horror show. but yeah, I totally get that. I kind of, you know, looking through the book, it's very much, it's not sex for sex sake.
Yeah.
If that kind of follows. It's very much the intimacy of the two people and what their particular vibe is.
That's purely a personal preference. I know that the kinds of stories that I am more drawn to are the ones where, you know, the emotions are on display, where there's more intimacy than just getting down.
Yeah.
So that was purely a personal
choice of, okay, that's, yeah. You know what, and it works really well, because there's no the term that I guess is kicking around the time, there's no kink shame to this book.
Mm-hmm.
It wears its heart on its sleeve very well, and I think it reads better for it. There's no apologies. And well, if you think,
go ahead.
Yeah, go for it. No, try.
I think what it comes down to is just I'm sort of the opinion that it's like, it's if it's safe, sane, and consensual, like people can do what they want.
Uh-huh.
And so if it's not something I have a problem with, I don't want to make anyone else feel like there is something to be ashamed of.
Good call. And you know what? That's kind of that at the end of the book, when I put it down, regardless of the sexy times in the book, to use its title, I found the book very uplifting. I thought I put it down and I was like, wow, that was such a great read.
Oh, thank you. That's exactly what I was looking for. I really wanted it to be a gift for people who, you know, picked it up.
It's very reaffirming, because to me, the sex is fun, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But it's the emotions in each one of the stories that absolutely drive the book. If that makes sense. It's very much like, maybe in different tones and different style, but there is something in it that reminds me of Sunstone, mm-hmm. by Stefan Cech.
Because
you've got Ali and Lisa, and when you start the book, they're kind of just playing and kind of wondering what's going on. By the end of the book, you know, I don't even care what they're wearing. I don't care what they're up to. I don't care. I've spoken to Stefan about this, and I'm like, dude, if these two break up, I will find you and I will hurt you. You know? Because that's what I want to see. I want to see them two make it work. The rest of it's smoke and mirrors, eventually. Yeah. But the core point, it's those two characters. And I think your anthology takes that, I want to say recipe, but that vibe, that theme, that recognition, if that's even the word, of the human ability to love, to be loved, and to open themselves up, and takes it that step further. So hats off. Round of applause, very much so.
I really wanted... I wanted the characters and the interpersonal relationships between them to be appealing enough that even if the story you were reading was not a dynamic that you were interested in, you would still care about what was happening with the characters.
Okay.
Which is something why I find the Sunstone comments so complimentary, because that is definitely not my scene, but I also very much care about the characters, and that's what I was trying to emulate.
Cool. Excellent. Well, mission accomplished. Well done. The Psychology of Sex. I have to say, without giving too much of my own personal life away, I recognize so many elements of this in this book. Mm-hmm. And from it wasn't kind of just the act about it. It's like that initial first time you're with someone. Even as you get older, the first time you're with somebody new and all that sort of stuff, all those feelings are definitely on the page.
Yeah. I definitely wanted, in addition to having different dynamics, female, male, male, I also wanted to have them at different phases of a relationship, whether it's a first meeting or they've been married for years, and also different phases of their lives. So yeah. I wanted a variety of age groups to be available to the audience.
And body shapes.
Yes, shapes.
Yeah, which is, again, there's no shame in this book at all. There's no kink shame, there's no body shame, there's no gender shame. What you've got across each story are a couple of characters, and you get a snippet of their life.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really big task to do, isn't it? That cross-section across so many different variables. How did you manage to keep all the plates spinning?
I think I already knew it. It helps when you know the character's bigger story beforehand.
Spoilers. There's a bigger story. Excellent.
Well,
volume two.
No, I mean, like, I know, as the author, I know what it looks like when they're dealing with the crisis. I know what their, you know, world-saving techniques are. I know how their lives play out.
All right.
Going in and taking a little snippet of their life just becomes a problem, an editing issue. And it becomes really, it's far easier to tell a short story than it is a long story.
All right, okay.
Not just because it's less because it requires less time, but also just because you can keep only the best bits in.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, so that made it very easy for me to decide what information was going to amuse the most, what was going to lead to more empathy, you know.
I am well jealous, because you get to know everything, and I've only got these little snippets. God damn it, that's not fair. You know what happens, son of a.
Well, if I'm lucky enough to get another book, I will maybe revisit some of the characters in addition to a new cast.
Fine, I'll hold it. All right, okay. Which is your favorite couple? Ooh, big question.
My favorite couple is probably going to be Charlotte and Owen. They're two supervillains, different levels, degrees of supervillainy. Charlotte is sort of a Poison Ivy type, where she can cause a lot of chaos on a global scale if she wanted to. And Owen is more of a thief type. So, you know, smaller scale.
Uh-huh.
But I just love their story so much. And I love Charlotte is very reassuring throughout the entire thing. And there's a degree of awkwardness to their story that I appreciate. That leaning into, because I really, when talking about stuff like kink and what other people are into, I don't want anybody to feel like they should be ashamed of what they like, as long as, you know, like I said, safe, sane, and consensual, then, you know, they deserve to find a partner who's supportive.
Totally. Totally.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's like you're reading my notes, basically. I would say that that story is probably my favorite out of a lot of them, because and we'll talk a little bit about the art in a little while, there was, it's the vulnerability.
Yes. It's
the vulnerability of the male character. You'll have to forgive me, I wrote Shade down rather than the civilian name. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's
So Shade, he's kind of like, he's putting it out there. And
yeah.
And he's got this great thing going on, and if he shares this one thing, it could go one way or the other. And it's great because nobody who hasn't read the book has no idea what you're talking about. So we're not going to tell you, so you have to go out and buy the book. There you go.
Yes. Yes.
No spoilers here. So I think I'll touch on the art a little bit here, actually. When it came to that story, the panel structure seemed slightly different. And it felt, flicking through and reading the book, I've read the book several times, that the pages and the panels on it were more open in some ways. So when you've got Amelia and Titan, for example, because their situation is quite tense, it looks like the panels are more constricted to try and get that motion across. Whereas with Shade and Recluse, then they're very much open because that's the kind of conversation they're trying to have. Was that something that you kind of played on as an artist, or
maybe,
or was it just a happy coincidence?
I rely a lot on happy coincidences.
Sweet.
when I'm doing my artwork. I never know. I get maybe for each book that I do, maybe one or two pages where it's like, I know exactly how this needs to end up looking. The rest of it is sort of like, this is the best option with the time constraints I have. Let's just see how it plays out.
Okay. The other point I'd like to make, I guess, in the Cavi and Kara story.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'll tell you what, I'll change that a little bit. In so many of these stories, there is so much well-observed humor. And we talk about the art, but it's like when we'll go back to Shade a second, he's trying to tell something, and she's like, oh my god, it's a wire. And you're like, honestly, I laughed so loud. It was like unbelievable.
Oh good.
And I was like, what, it just proper hit the mark, and you're like, oh, okay. And it was just a fun throwaway line that kind of helps draw you into the characters. It's the same with Amelia and Titan. A lot of their conversation is kind of, it's stilted because of the different areas they're at. You've got one quite experienced and one inexperienced, and that awkwardness is formed by the stilted conversation. So Cavi and Kara, for example, that chaoticness that's in their story.
Yeah.
I had to laugh. I laughed all the way through.
Oh, good. Another point that was really important to me with this story is just, I knew it had to be sexy, but I also wanted it to have the element of humor and awkwardness. That's because that is as true to real life sexy times as every other as you know, the
totally.
Hot tense moments, you know,
totally.
That yeah. And
I've written it down as the chaos of trying too hard.
Yeah. And you know, like, I wanted to take the pressure off for readers who maybe haven't fully come out of the idea that it needs to be this mind-blowing experience each time. And if it's not, it's like a failure. I think that people get it into their heads, you know, that it has to be this big, huge thing.
Yeah.
When it's just another interpersonal, like, bonding exercise. Yeah.
I totally get it. I say to there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of pressure, I think, through mainstream media that for sex to be enjoyable, you know, I say mainstream, so apologies if I deviate to just a kind of, I guess, generic version. You know, the woman's got to have her orgasm and the bloke's got to have his orgasm, or vice versa. And you're kind of like, you know, it sometimes doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Sometimes nobody gets off and you're not.
It's like, you know, and what made me laugh the most, it was the lamp and then the cat.
Yes.
And I'm like, that. It's like, that is so, I'll tell a secret, all right? So me and Mrs. H, we're in this house, we're a big, nice house, three-story thing, and we're having super fun, sexy times. And nice and romantic, and in the throes of passion, a pillow gets knocked onto the nightstand. That's all well and good until we realise, of course, there's a candle on the nightstand.
Oh, no.
Then the pillow goes up. Then some of my clothes go on fire. And before we know it, we're chucking the last of the wine on the fire and my clothes are getting stained and stuff. And we were, at the time, we were like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. But it's funny because the next couple of days when people were saying things like, oh, yeah, it must be hot stuff in bed and all that sort of stuff, we smiled and laughed and like, yeah, we are. We set the place.
Yeah.
You know? And it is such, it became, because we told our friends, it became such like an urban myth type of thing.
Yeah.
You know? And you just got to stand up and applaud and say, you know what? Yeah, it happened. Bring it on. You know? But it just.
Yeah. It's as valuable a moment in your relationship as all those other, as the sexy times. It's, it's another, you know, building block into it.
It was a great way for Mrs. Hughes to get rid of that shirt that she hated that I had. So, yeah, great. I think she planned it, really. how is it working as a writer and an artist? Do you ever give yourself a hard time? Writer Meredith goes, man, that artist Meredith is such a bitch. How could she do this? And vice versa.
It's usually, because I always usually write it, I have a rule that I need to know, like, how a story is going to play out before I really start it. So It's almost always fully written before I start on art. I do hate myself sometimes for the things I write. And sometimes as I'm writing them, I'm like, I know I'm looking at myself and going, I'm going to be so pissed off whenever I have to actually draw this. It's inevitable. It has to be this way.
Do you give yourself a pep talk? Come on, we can do this. Go on.
I just sort of like, it's going to suck, but it's months and months away.
The delay tactic.
But also you also give yourself a hard time during both processes because you're working on it for so long, you lose objectivity. So when I'm writing, like, I'm really happy for you to hear you say that you laughed out loud at some of the jokes, because when you're writing jokes, like, they get old so fast. You're like, am I even funny anymore? Yeah. Was I ever funny?
In my day job, I'm a trainer, so I help people find jobs. That's my day job. And when I start a new course, I always check to see who's on there, because if it's someone I've already seen once, I know for a fact I'm gonna have to change my jokes, because it's like they'll have heard them already. So I'm like, can't say that now. Have to say this, someone else. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
I feel the pain.
And then that repetitiveness extends to the artwork, because you're looking at a page for so long. You're like, is this even good? Is this worth looking at?
The answer to the question is yes, it is worth looking at. Of course
it
is.
Thank you.
It's a gorgeous book.
But boy, by the time you're done with it, you're like, I'm going to put this book away and move on to the next thing.
So... you provide your own colors as well, is that right?
I do.
You do. So is it a digital scheme that you use?
I think this was the first book I did that's completely digital. I penciled, inked, and colored digitally. Before this, I would pencil and ink by hand and then color digitally. But this one, I had my new fancy Cintiq monitor.
Check you out.
Yeah.
I'm on a Surface Pro, so I still have pencils. So
I need to get a hold of something that's a little smaller so I can, like, you know, travel with it.
I'm thinking of getting the new Galaxy Note because it's got a bigger screen than a phone, but not as big as a tablet. But I'm a doodler. I don't draw with any great panache. So how was it? How did you find it working digitally as opposed to working on mixed media like pencils, then digital stuff?
There are definitely advantages, like, you know, endless, you know, backspace key is nice.
Undo, click.
Yes, undo.
Redo. I like that.
Yeah.
Unredo. That's what I want.
It's especially nice when I'm inking because it's like, you know, there are moments, though, when I feel like because working by hand has a finality to it, that it feels like pencils and inks by hand might go faster.
Okay.
Ooh, but I don't know that that's true. I think it's more of a frame of mind that I get into than that has any actual truth to it.
Okay. Cool. I think I know what you mean. It's kind of my when I doodle, when I draw characters and stuff, I always find that the pencils look great, but then the inks, I go too far.
Mm-hmm.
So I drew a Wonder Woman picture for my wife a few years back. And once I got the face done, I photocopied it like a gazillion times so I could practice with the inks before I then took on the main inks. And so, and that's how I did the process. By the time I was finished, I had one picture and like 37,000 different photocopies kicking around the place.
Yeah. Well, I mean, thankfully, that's a time when having deadlines is actually helpful because it's like you sort of looking at yourself going, I have to do this today. I don't get a second shot. It needs to be done.
Yeah. I suppose the temptation with digital is always to go one step too far, or just it's like trying to trim the perfect bonsai tree.
Yeah.
There's always like one clip, and then you take it like just that next step. But no, so I see what you're pointing about the finality of pencils. Once it's penciled, once it's inked in like on paper, that's it. You can't touch it anymore. Next.
Yeah.
But digitally, you know, you can ink bigger spaces and color bigger spaces quicker, which is always kind of good. What made Omni Press the place for the book? Because to use a phrase, sex sells, and we know there's publishers out there that do a range of different books. I mean, we've already touched on Sunstone, which has been fantastic for Image, and so you kind of think there's other companies out there. I'm just, what was it about Omni Press that said this is the place?
I've worked with them before for Hopeless Savages, which is written by Jen Van Meter. It's a wonderful set of books. I highly recommend it. But I only worked on volume 4. So I had a standing relationship with them. That went well. And they were the first ones to ask. So,
okay,
cool. Yeah. I don't think at that point anyone had asked me to do anything adult yet. And I was primed. I was ready to do something adult. So it was just really good timing.
So Gem and the Holograms kind of did your fix initially, did it?
I think I would have ended up where I did anyway. I had, even before Gem and the Holograms, I had done an illustration series called Man Smut Monday. Which, as the title would indicate, it's drawing sexy men every Monday. And the reason I did it initially was just because I knew I needed to practice with the male form.
Okay.
more. I kind of shied away from it. And that let people know that I was, you know, available for that kind of work. And then also, I think, I don't know, I think it was just what was picking up an interest on the internet. It seemed like everyone was starting to do their own little adult side Twitters and, yeah. You know.
Do you think then, because just taking a step back a little bit, if everyone's kind of doing adult books, do you think that the mood around adult books has kind of changed a little bit? Obviously, you're still going to get like the titillation of Zenoscope and their stuff. But do you think that adult books are now becoming a bit of a more recognized for as an art form, as a storytelling medium, rather than just generic TNA?
I think it comes in waves. I think each new wave brings something new in, and a higher level of acceptance for a wider range of people. But you know, it's an ebb and a flow, and I think that's true for many genres. Like a decade ago, I don't know that we'd be having the kind of conversations we're having today about horror or or musicals, or you know, I think they come and they go out of favor, and you know, you're just really lucky if you manage to hit the note as it's picking up steam or while it's picking up steam.
Okay, I think if I may be so bold, I think you're underselling yourself a massive amount with that, because I think, as we've alluded to, there can be books like TNA books, like Zenoscope books, and they don't mind being that, and they've got a whole circle of fans around that sort of stuff. Books like Super Fun Sexy Times, okay, at the start, the first couple of pages, like, wow, what's this? And by the time you finish the book, it's about the human condition, the same way Sunstone is, the same way a lot of those other books can tend to be. I think there needs to be, I guess, a little bit of differentiation between sex for sex's sake and sex as part of the human condition and the human interaction. And I think you definitely fall in the latter, and you do so very, very well.
Thank you.
So all that was meant as a compliment.
You know, it's hard for me to have a I forget what the word is. My perspective on what's normal or what's in vogue, or you know, what people want, I think is informed by the bubble that I'm in of people. And I happen to surround myself with people who or immerse myself with people who are very sex positive, are bringing their own personal feelings into the stories. You know, they're telling, they may not be telling a story about themselves, but they are putting themselves on the page still.
All right.
And so for me, it seems more like the norm when, you know, I kind of have to remind myself that not everybody has that awareness or is that's just not everybody's life, you know?
Well, you know what? That's a really good valid point, and it really is. And I think the book goes some way to kind of even out the playing field a little bit.
Yeah.
I would like to get away from the term normal and just say natural instead.
Yeah.
Because reading the book to the characters in the book, what they're doing feels natural to them.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a very good point.
to get the characters, it's got to feel natural to you as the reader. So whether or not one thing or the other is your kink or not your kink, right? The fact is that they exist and they are somebody's kink. That's why there's 57 varieties, man. Not everybody likes tomato soup.
Yes.
Yeah, so...
Exactly. You know,
so I meant to say it earlier, to be fair, but it's the relationships within the book are natural. And I think that's a really key core strength as well. Yeah. It feels like a natural relationship.
Yeah.
Better doing a volume two. That's all I'm always
saying. Yeah. I think part of like I said earlier, I read a lot of shoujo manga as a child. A lot of that is romance. And a lot of it is, even as you're reading it, even at the age I was at, I'm like, this is very unrealistic. You fall in love that fast. And I don't think these actions are healthy. as a better example, I think they did a study a couple years back where they found that what people did in romance movies, the things they did for the lengths of love in romance movies, while people love that movie, people also realized that if any of it had happened in real life, they would have been very creeped out.
Of course.
Well, you know, it's stuff like, you know, when the dude tracks down where you work because he's just smitten with you. So I think there's a disconnect. There was always a disconnect when I was reading these romance books where I'm like, this is very romantic in fiction, but I know that if it had happened in real life, I would have freaked out.
You know, you've just spoiled the dreams of thousands of Twilight fans now by saying that, right?
Twilight, you know, it. You just walk a fine line with when talking about Twilight, because I don't want to discourage girls who like it from using it as a jumping off point to figure themselves out. But there are a lot of elements too where you're like, but I hope you figure out as you get older that these elements are not healthy in a relationship.
Yes. I'm glad you said that. I totally concur. And this is speaking to someone who's been dragged to every single of the movies.
Yeah. Yeah. And I went to the first one. Or was it the first? No, it was the second one. I went to the second one. And also I think I made myself. Okay. As a part of the event of going to the premiere of Twilight 2, my friends somebody was marketing these like fruit pouches, but they had them packaged like blood bags and they had a huge amount of iron in them. So they tasted copper. They tasted like blood.
Okay.
So we did a shot of those before the movie started as like, you know, this is an event. And it made me so ill. It made me so ill. And then I had to sit through the movie.
which was like worse.
Like
I said,
I'm not going to shame anyone who got something from the experience of seeing that movie or reading the books. Like I said, I understand where its value is to other people, but it was not where I was at the time. That it wasn't what I needed from.
You should say that speech in front of Star Wars fans, because at the moment they're doing my head in. The fact is, people my age in the 40s are complaining about the new Star Wars movies, forgetting the fact that Star Wars was never meant for 40-year-olds. It's a kid's film.
Yeah, well, it's like, who was... there's a really good documentary, and now I can't remember Now I can't remember what it was called. Oh, it's like The People versus George Lucas or something.
All right, okay.
I highly recommend it. It's about his whole career, how it's affected people, and it's very fan conscious. It's more about how fans reacted to his work,
uh-huh.
both good and bad, and you know where people took those stories afterwards. Uh-huh. And there's a part where they talk about, you know, it gets as far as episodes 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
When those were released and how difficult it was for fans to adjust, previous fans to adjust to these new stories. And I think it was Simon Pegg who was talking about how he realized that Jar Jar Binks was kids of today's Ewoks.
Yep.
But and how his parents hated Ewoks and didn't understand their appeal. And it's I think there's a lot to be gained in stepping back from something and going, maybe this isn't for me. Like I can still enjoy it if I can enjoy it.
Yeah.
But it might not be for me. Like it's like with the all the live action Disney movies coming out. Uh-huh. You know. Yes, the previous animated movies have a place in our hearts, of course, and they will stand on their own. But maybe these new movies are for a new generation, and maybe it will be as important to them as the other ones were to us. And you know, it's not taking anything away from us.
Exactly, and we should applaud that because they're getting into the stories. So, again, in one of my groups, we were talking about Star Wars, and someone said Revenge of the Sith was the best Star Wars movie, and I was like, it isn't. Empire Strikes Back is. It always will be. And then I said, did you go to the pictures to see Sith? And he goes, yeah, I went to the pictures to see all the first three when I was a kid. And that's when it dawned on me. That's when I had my light bulb moment. I was like, that's what it is. That's when you first saw Star Wars. So that's always going to be your barometer, your bar is always going to be that.
Yeah.
It's just the same way for me, it's the like 4, 5, and 6. Or kids nowadays, 7, 8, and 9 coming up. So, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
We've digressed. So you mentioned earlier.
There's so much fertile ground in Star Wars, you know?
Yeah.
Are they still going forward with the live action television show too?
As far as I know, but I've got to be honest, you've hit kind of a nerve because this whole Disney thing, this whole Disney streaming service, it only happens in the US. UK can't get it.
No!
Yeah, you know the whole...
No!
You know the DC Universe stuff?
Oh, that's so lame!
We don't get that either, apart from Titans on Netflix. So I hear all this stuff about the Mandalorian this and the Obi-Wan Kenobi series that. I'm not going to be able to watch this. Thanks, Disney.
Oh, no, that's so lame. I'm so sorry. I know those feels because there are a fair few British shows that come out where, you know, I have enough friends across the pond that,
all right, okay,
you know, they'll be raving about it. And I'm like, when will it come to America? Or will it come to America, or will we try to remake it for American audiences?
You've intrigued me. What's your British shows that you're looking for then?
Oh, I don't know that there's anything right now. I would have really liked it if the Misfits had found a bigger home here in America. Oh,
good call. It's a great series. Yeah. Great series.
Yeah, I think
you guys.
I found out about it from my dad, who had to he had to go through unique channels to find all of it.
Fair enough. You guys remade Lost in Life on Mars, didn't you?
I think we did.
With the guy that ended up
doing it. I don't think it did very well. I know we remade, and then we did the same thing with Broadchurch. And it was sort of like, maybe just bring, it's funny because it feels hypocritical because I just had this conversation about remaking things for a different audience. But there's also a truth to acknowledging that some stories make more sense with the cultural cues they grew from.
Totally.
It's like, what was it? There was a Japanese movie that America remade with, it's called Shall We Dance? And it was remade with Jennifer Lopez and Richard Gere. And while I knew that it would still be a perfectly okay movie, having seen the Japanese version and knowing what the cultural significance of ballroom dancing was, because it was different than here in the West. For the Japanese, there was some stigma attached to it. I knew we were never going to get that across in a film for Western audiences, and that sort of, I think that took away from the story a bit.
Cool. It's very rare to find a film like High Fidelity, which seems, I've read the book by Nick Hornby and I've seen the film with John Cusack, and it's one of those rare things where there's a synergy, where they both work.
Yeah.
But if it was something else, I totally get it. It loses the nuance that drove the story forward, or the circumstance that drove the story.
Yeah, I think whenever the question of, you know, should we remake this comes up, you have to ask yourself, are there cultural touchstones important to this that cannot be removed or cannot be negotiated around? And is there something we can bring to, can we still bring value to it if we transplant it, you know?
So this will explain why the Brits don't have a Baywatch or a Knight Rider.
Yeah, I don't think it would work.
Not with our weather, it wouldn't. Right, you've mentioned that you
can have it in Ibiza.
That's bonkers. That'd be class. Okay, so you mentioned that you kind of try and stay on track of comics for conversational purposes. Are there any comic creators out there at the moment that you make a kind of beeline for with your very limited time? Feel free to say no.
I usually always make time to look at Ogloff.
Okay.
Which is a weekly updated webcomic. It's OGLAF. It is, God, they've been going for I think a decade now. But it's D&D with sex jokes, basically. And each comic strip is its own like standalone thing. They had an ongoing story towards the beginning, but they've stepped away from that now. It just reminds me of Sunday cartoons, but it's raunchy.
Okay. Well, I have a friend on our other podcast who's a huge D&D fan. So I'm just going to send her the link. It's called Ogloff, did you say?
Yeah.
O-G-L-A-F.
Right, yeah. Okay. And it's also, they do occasionally do strips that are not raunchy, that are safe for work. And they are very nice enough to provide two different lists in their archives where these are the safe comics, these are the unsafe comics, which is something I really appreciate.
Yeah. Oh, don't. Because you remind me of... So I was in a queue looking at my Twitter and somebody shook their head at me. And I was like, sorry, what? And they said, you shouldn't be looking at pictures like that in a public place. I was like, okay, does it offend you? They're like, yeah, it does. I was like, well, stop looking over my shoulder then. You know, it's simple as.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
move on.
Twitter's become a much... ever since... Since Tumblr got rid of became more stringent about what kind of adult content they can have, my Twitter has since become like 30% thirstier as a result.
Do you find that it comes in peaks and troughs? So I don't know if it's a time zone thing, but I'll get up in the morning and my Twitter is full of the thirsty stuff. Then by about lunchtime, it turns into comics. And then by by tea time, so about 6 o'clock, it's a fair mix.
I think I know too many people across too many time zones now. So it's like it's always time to be thirsty somewhere.
It's always thirsty o'clock.
Yeah, exactly. Who else? One book I haven't picked it up yet, but it's so gorgeous. I know I need to. I need to like break my non-reading fast and pick it up. What is it? Paula Deen Keeps Breaking Up With Me.
Okay.
It's gorgeous. It's a very, and I don't know the artist's name off the top of my head, but it's very simple artwork. It's gray tones with pink highlights. They did such a fantastic job with their limited palette. And, you know, every line stroke is very intentional. And it's just like, why can't I be this economical with my artwork? It's like there's nothing in there that's unnecessary.
Okay. I don't know. I think maybe you're almost critical. I think your art works really well. I think there's a simplicity. There's a lot of emotion shown on the faces in the books I've read, which is, when you think about the kind of conversation we've just had, is paramount. You want to see the emotion rather than, you know, the action pause per se. But I think you've kind of touched on something that every book can have its own different art style. It doesn't have to be dynamic. It doesn't have to have bold colors, because your color scheme is quite pastel in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it is. I always, and, you know, this is a problem for most creatives. You're always the hardest on yourself. So it's like, even though I'm like low key down on myself, please pick up my book. I swear I put a lot of effort into it. You always have to remind yourself. Somebody posted a joke where it's like, how you think your creation is going to be received, and it's somebody putting a less decorative cake next to like a three-tiered wedding cake, and they're like, oh, forget that cake. And then they're like, but how the audience sees it is, hey, two cakes. And so it's like, you know, be aware. You're there. It's going to be enjoyed. It's going to find an audience, you know.
Totally. I think you're bang on right. You know, the amount of people I speak to when they say, oh, this doesn't work or that doesn't work. And I look at it and I think, whoa, really? Really? However. So if you, for those that are interested, go and check Comic Crusaders for a review of the book by yours truly. There's still no spoilers in there, so you'll have to buy the book still. Sorry.
I'm impressed that you managed to write a review without any spoilers. Kudos.
Well, I hinted at a couple of things, but I haven't given any of the... I kind of touch on some of the elements that are in there. Because I was so impressed. I was so blown away. I was like... So I haven't seen some of the topics in this book I haven't seen so sensitively done in such a long time, that it was kind of, as I said, that wake up moment.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So
there you go. Yeah. When I was going through the book, like I have been more nervous about the reception of this book than any other book I've done, because I knew I was dealing with subjects that were sensitive to people. And, you know, because I was dealing with a wide variety of relationships and dynamics and kinks, I was dealing with things that I don't have experience in or am not as personally attached to. And so I was very aware that I could make a crucial misstep at any time.
Cool. The fear factor. All right. Okay. Time for the last question. You ready?
Sure.
Big question. I've been saving it for ages. Is your mom pleased now that you can afford your own dental insurance?
She is. She still thinks I'm underemployed. But she is pleased that, you know, that my teeth are straight and shiny.
Cool.
I know.
So, So basically, if you're underpaid, what artist Meredith should do is have a word with writer Meredith to get a page count knocked up a little bit, a page rate.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
We're working on it. We're working on it. Things are moving. Wheels are turning.
I can just imagine the conversation. No, I will not pay me more money.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Excellent.
So, I mean, I'm lucky. A lot of people, at least here in the U.S., who are in the comics community, to be successful, they have to invest all the work into the comic at the front end with no guarantee that it will find a home or get kickstarted or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it still works better. It's easier to sell to an audience or a publisher when it's all done. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, so a lot of us are in the position where we have to do the work in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And then just hope for the best. Hope that there's some pay at the end.
Are you going to any cons this fall?
No, not this fall.
Yeah.
I'm waiting to hear a couple of conventions that I'm waiting to hear back from for next year are either doing lotteries or curating. So I still don't know if I even have a table at them yet.
So you need to come over to Thought Bubble in the UK.
I know, I really do.
You would love Thought Bubble.
I know. I've been to MCM London, and I know you have one coming up soon. Excuse me. And that was a lot of fun. And you know, I'm not going to turn down international travel. So what I really need is for them to invite me there as a guest.
Well, I'll see what I can do. All right. Thought Bubble is a great place for indie writers and creators. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, that's what I've been hearing. I know a few people who have been going and have made it a regular stop on their convention circuit because they had such a great time.
Cool. Excellent. All right. That's it for tonight's episode of Outside the Panels. Meredith, where can people find your book? It's out in comic book shops now. Is it also out on Comixology or... Omnipress.
I think it's in Comixology. I haven't checked. Sorry. I'm really bad at promotion. As
all right. So,
I know it's on Amazon. I know it's in comic shops now.
So also check out the Omnipress Lime Rents Press website to see where you can get the book. I personally can wholeheartedly recommend it. It's a fantastic read, start to finish.
Thank you.
You're more than welcome. All that's left for me to say is thank you, Meredith, for spending the time. Totally enjoyed that. And don't forget to listen to the rest of the Undercover Capes pod network for all your other favourite pods, including The Definitive Crusade, Flipside Focus, and of course, the House of X special phenomenon that is the No Prize podcast. This is Joining the Machine Hughes saying see ya.
Visit UndercoverCapes.com for the latest and greatest podcasts via the Undercover Capes Podcast Network. Also visit our parent company website, ComicCrusaders.com, all about comic pop culture.